Hello and welcome to the Ride AI podcast. I'm your host, Ed Niedermeyer. As I reflect on the last decade or so of tumultuous change and investment in the mobility technology ecosystem, one of the concepts that I keep coming back to that has this perennial value in looking at and understanding where things are going in the mobility technology space is this idea that you may have come across called unbundling the car. This is something that I came across quite a few years ago now when I encountered someone who has been immensely influential on my own thinking about all of these things. And that is Horace DeDieu, who you may know as the godfather of micromobility, the man who came up with the term micromobility. But he's also someone who has, as I said, been deeply influential on my thinking about cars, about autonomous vehicles, about any number of mobility technologies. So I'm really thrilled to once again be able to sit down and have a conversation with him about the idea of unbundling the car, what that means, and what it doesn't mean. Horace, thank you so much for sitting down with me today.
Well, Ed, you're very kind, and I thank you so much as well. I would also say that I've been deeply influenced by your writing over the years in your conversations with respect to not just electric cars, but self-driving and the entire questions of mobility that are influencing us. So yeah, I think that the respect is mutual. So thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, it's, you know, we picked a really fascinating time to be interested in cars and mobility. And I think for both of us, you know, cars are sort of the entry point for exploring now this exploding, you know, world of mobility technology. And so I want to start sort of there. What sort of drew you to cars in the first place?
Well, so personally, actually, I have a very peculiar history because I did not have a car. My family didn't have a car until I was about 17 years old. We were immigrants, and we actually refugees, and we didn't have money. We didn't have cars in the countries we lived before the United States. And even in the United States, my father commuted to his work by bus or subway, and we didn't get a car until 1984, and I was born in 1968. So you can imagine my early formative years were unaffected by automobiles. But once I went to college, you know, I got more and more interested in cars, but I studied engineering, and obviously you can't miss that technology. But really what got me involved with thinking strategically about it has been actually all the way up until 2014. And it was the start of the rumors about Apple Car. And of course, I was an Apple analyst. But also I was at the Christensen Institute, and I was thinking about what should we look at as a forecast of the technology evolution through disruptive theory, having seen and witnessed the computing and mobile telephony transitions and entertainment and a bunch of other things. But I was curious about what we're going to see with transportation, because also there was questions about the environment. There was a question about global warming, and transportation is a 25% component of that emission, right, of the carbon footprint. So obviously, I just came at it quite late in life, and I only started thinking about it as a technology and/business quite late as well. And I like to point out that I studied it for 3 years deeply. I pulled all the data I could find. I built unique data sets. I looked at diffusion data. I looked at how fast things go for 140 different technologies while being a researcher at this think tank. And I looked at it every angle. And I the way I say about the story about micromobility being born there is that I drew a blank. The candidates that were looking very promising since 2014, succinctly summarized by McKinsey as CASE, C-A-S-E, this acronym of communications, autonomy, sharing, and electric. The CASE, all these vectors, all these four things, and many people are saying that they're all going to just be explosively powerful, but in conjunction, all those four things happening at once would cause a supernova type of innovation, explosion in adoption, all the things that we had been struggling with in terms of speed of change in automotive, right? I complain about the fact that automotive is very slow. We use the phrase, the faster it goes, the slower it goes, to explain that the faster the vehicle, the slower it is to change. So the bicycle changes very quickly while the airplane changes very slowly. And that's a remarkable kind of observation. And the car is somewhere in the middle, and it's, you know, it takes years. And so in my education of automobility, I observed these things, and I concluded that, firstly, of the four things, the case, each one has a different speed. Communications, autonomy, sharing. Sharing was first, arguably. Communications is second. It's pretty much common nowadays. Electric is coming up, but as you can see, it has hiccups. And it's taken, by the way, just happy birthday to Tesla while we're on the subject. I don't know exact date when Tesla was born, but this is the year when Tesla turns 20. So it's been a 20-year-old run for Tesla, which is considered a pioneer and a really go-getter. So 20 years, and obviously electric cars precede Tesla and so on. But so things go slow for electric. And then finally, autonomy, which, again, the dreams are very, very prevalent back in 2014. And now we're seeing somewhat of a disillusionment. So, again, all of these things are on different time cycle, different adoption rates, right, and different constraints. Some of them actually are contrary to one another. Like, if you want to have autonomy, you need to be highly, actually, energy intensive because you're using a lot of compute. You need to be very data intensive so you don't have the communications. And so they're contradicting somewhat the EV dream and the communications dream. And the sharing model is competing with the others because the sharing model says we want to have drivers that are sort of gig economy workers, and then we want to replace drivers in the other case. Well, okay, fine. It would be great. And then sharing combines with autonomy and sort of like one disappears. So there's a lot of things that don't quite, congeal together. But nonetheless, this was the dream. It's been a long hike, 10 years now, 2014. And, I drew a blank. I really was about 2-3 years into that. I was like, I don't see it happening in the way that I knew disruption would happen. And so I switched tacks to micromobility, thinking the really low end. So the way I summarize it is that the world is looking for all those case things to make a better car. But the funny thing is the cars are pretty darn good. Actually, they're more than good. They're a bit too good. And one of the things you learn in disruption theory is when something is so good that it's kind of like scrambling for things to sell you, cup holders and entertainment systems that have nothing to do with transportation, nothing to do with A to B. When you get to that point, you got to start asking questions that maybe they're overshooting. And then somebody who comes in with a really bare bones product would probably have an interesting foothold. And that's what micromobility is. It's like short trips, not a lot of cargo, not a lot of cup holders in micromobility, not a lot of seven seats and off-road capability, like somehow those are important, or the ability to, tow a boat. Again, I'm not sure most people do that. So when you ask about that, the theory, the thing I was steeped in back, it's in 20 years now, more or more in disruption theory, it wasn't ringing any bells. So my objection was that I didn't think those things would come together quickly, and I didn't think that necessarily they're going to make a better, what I call a worse car or a good enough car. They're going to make a superlative car. All of the things we talk about are more expensive, more potentially priced into a high-end premium product. And as a result, exactly this was what followed, is that the EV market, which was kind of where the money is, was all about premium and all about luxury, and it more so as we go along. We're still struggling to see where's that low end. A truly disruptive thing, it starts at the low end. It starts at the really crappy car. So I summarized it by saying the world seemed to be offering a better car, but I said, wake me up You know, give me a call when the world comes up with the worst car. Because if whenever you come up with the worst car, you're worse again by the meaning of low end. Remember, Toyota was the worst car when it launched in the United States. Volkswagen was the worst car when it launched in Europe. Model T was the worst car when it launched in 1914 because there were all these luxury brass era cars. Every single entry in the automotive world that shook it up, that changed it fundamentally, was a worse car. Remember the very first Kia, or at the time Hyundai, or the very first Land Rover, who created the whole off-road, was you know, like basically Jeep, which is a really bad car if you look at it, right? Jeep and other things in off-road, SUVs, all of those things were pretty rotten in the beginning. So yeah.
To paraphrase T.E. Lawrence, right? In the auto industry, big things have small and often ugly beginnings.
Yeah, exactly. And that's so brilliant. I'm going to steal that. It's just such a poetic thing. It's poetic. It's David Goliath. It's biblical stuff. We're not talking. So whenever someone's pitching and pounding the table on better, 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 it has to be better in a new dimension. It has to be better, not like saying it's faster, it's got more power or more seats. It's got to be kind of funkier. It's got to be funner. It's got to be interesting. And what the Japanese competed on was reliability, which seemed to be like, well, we don't really need that. We have decent enough cars in America. And then suddenly there's like, well, it starts all the time on the first turn of the key. How about that? You know, there's our competitive stance, right?
Absolutely.
So, at a time when cars really were problematic to even start in the cold and all kinds of other things. So anyway, my point is, now one of the things, sorry, I'm rambling a bit, but just focus on the bundling thing. So when you pull on this thread of, you know, good enough, micromobility, low end, asking what will change the world, one of the things you observe about automobility is that, okay, first of all, the short trip question, why are the people taking a long trip vehicle, like a car, which is suitable for long trips, and doing short trips with it? Because the data immediately pops out when you do any kind of analysis, is like most trips are short. They're below 3 miles. So if you took, let's say you cut off at 5 miles, let's say that's kind of like borderline of what might be considered a short trip in a micro vehicle, right? But you take that off, it's like almost half the trips are below that threshold. So why is it that we're using a big car with enormous power, enormous horsepower, enormous capacity, enormous range, enormous weight, all those things? It's like saying, I'm going to use my computer to make phone calls all the time. I'll just take it with me everywhere. Why not? Oh, it's very capable.
It's like, right, like the it's not a problem that sledgehammers exist, right? Sledgehammers are fine for the tasks that they're good for knocking down walls. But if most of the time, you know, you're killing mosquitoes with a sledgehammer, that's the problem, right? It's not the car itself. Yeah. It's what you're using the car for.
I'm just using the computing metaphor because we went through that transition where we kind of had great computers and, you know, everybody was asking, make it better. And then what Apple did and others is just that they make them smaller. Nobody was asking for small pocket size computing that much. Or if they did, it was like to make phone calls only. And they said, no, it's a phone and it's a computer, which actually lets you browse and do apps and all these other things. And when that happened to get refined enough, everybody moved over there. So it's kind of 80-20 rule. You still have a computer. I'm speaking to you on one right now, but I'm also 80% of the time using my phone for most of the tasks I need to do. Now, I've lived through that transition. I understood it. And I said, okay, that made Apple billions or, you know, trillions actually in market cap, Google as well, and so on. And Microsoft before that made the PC viable versus a bigger computer. So things just got smaller and smaller and therefore more people use them and so on. Now, the bundling concept came into my thought because I said, if you take short trips and long trips and medium trips, one person, two persons, five persons, cargo, no cargo, you take that, all these things and you say, well, one size fits all. Yes, it does, but it's not optimal. And why do we not try to unbundle the car the way we've unbundled computing so that we end up with good, you know, big, medium, and small computer, tablet, phone, maybe even watch, maybe even cloud, maybe even wearables, like I'm speaking to you through AirPods now. So you have all these, you know, microprocessors end up in all of these things, and they're all pretty powerful, by the way. And they're all communicating, they're all connected, and all that. So we have no problem living in the world of multiple devices, and we don't care. Oh, so most objections, by the way, in the beginning was like, well, you can't use a tablet to write programs or to do spreadsheets or a phone. And I was like, well, so what? Use your computer for that. What's wrong with that? They just were so defensive. It's like, so the response of car enthusiasts to this hypothesis has been exactly the same as that PC enthusiasts responded to the mobile phone. They said, it's not good enough. Yes, not for everything. We're not asking you to do everything with this. So if you are going to go to grandma's house with the whole family Christmas, by all means, get in your car. So by the way, it's not even, I mean, I'm not a, you know, going to be dogmatic that micro is the answer, but it could also be other solutions, which are services like, again, a shared vehicle or a smart vehicle or a self-driving one. And then here's the point about why I think this, when we talk about the conversation of what is the future of autonomous vehicles, I would challenge people to say, well, why should it be a feature in a car which you use infrequently enough? Like essentially, the utilization of a car is abysmal. It sits 96% of the time. It's only in use about 1 hour a day, and it's parked most of the time. So why do you want to cram it full of real power when that power could be better on a vehicle that's shared and updated more frequently? Because again, here's the other downside of the automobile model that we have as a personal vehicle that we buy. It is that it has to last a very long time. And it's because its utilization is so low. So the economics are very complicated. Let's say a car costs $80,000. Now, if it's going to be lasting 8 years, then it's costing the owner $10,000 a year. That's nearly $1,000 a month in just depreciation. Now, normally, that's a luxury depreciation which some people are willing to pay. But in most cases, that's too much to pay for transportation, especially as you haven't even added in insurance and fuel and maintenance and repairs and consumables and all these other things. So when you look at the economics, it's like there's the technology that we're talking about in terms of AI, the AI needed and the infrastructure for that, is just like piling onto a product, an object that doesn't have the sort of cycle time, right? On off time, and it doesn't have the longevity you need. You actually have too much longevity. You gotta be able to switch it up. Like a phone, you switch every couple of years now, right? A computer also. So if your car lasts 40 years, and I'm a fan of cars, by the way, I own a few very old cars and they're still working. And I'm asking myself, they're good enough, right? So anyway, sorry, I'm just going off. Yeah. Let me get to your question.
Yeah. I'm really glad you actually started this by talking about the Apple car. I feel like this bookends this era that we've just been living through really nicely, right? Where the Apple car, I think that was, you know, the time when you and others in the technology space were like, oh, cars, this is a lot of potential here. Let's explore it. Let's understand it. That really kicked off in a lot of ways, a lot of the investment and interest in what is beyond the car. And now we have, just in the last month or so, yeah, Apple saying, we spent billions of dollars to make specifically a car that was electric, that was a privately owned car that was electric and self-driving. They spent billions of dollars trying to do it. And to me, if Apple can't make that work, there's some really important lessons there, right?
And I would be careful. Yeah, it's not that they can't. It's just they have a very, very tough self. You know, they call it this notion of saying no to 1,000 good ideas. It may be a good idea, but they say no to it because they finally realize, I would say, that they can't bring what they have to bear in a way that also others cannot copy. There's this very important notion that what they have to bring is unique enough and difficult enough that profitable enough. So those things just didn't converge. And the reason I think it didn't converge is that they hung everything on self-driving, because otherwise, why? Otherwise, why? And this is the fundamental question. In fact, many people initially asked of Tesla, as I did, if it isn't self-driving, what's the point? I mean, the Japanese can make cars, the Germans can make cars, the Americans can, the Koreans, Chinese, they all can make cars that are electric or not. And the point is, at some point, okay, yeah, you have some early advantage with the first few years, but at some point, it's a commodity. So what are you going to do next? And it has to be self-driving. So even Elon Musk said, like, if it wasn't for the potential of self-driving, Tesla wouldn't be worth anything. So so that potential is still there. But I think Apple realized that that is just not coming together on the self-driving side the way they envisioned it. I think they envisioned it also as space. Yeah.
Yes, no, but I mean, specifically, you know, I think one of the fixed points, and this is where Apple and Tesla are, this is the commonality in their approach. There's a lot of differences, but the commonality is that they had this fixed, like, target of it has to be a car, right? We have to take these new electric and autonomous technologies and fit them into this established product class in a way that is familiar and recognizable and yet also amazing. And to me, this is the heart of Tesla's popularity, right? Like, I compare the big touchscreen to like tail fins on a Cadillac in the 50s. It's not a smartphone. Tesla's not a smartphone. There's no app ecosystem for it. It doesn't have the core, you know, things that really make a smartphone the game changer that it is. But it has the, right, just like a Cadillac wasn't jet powered, right? It wasn't a fighter jet, but it had the tail fins that made it look like it. It associated, so it was taking this recognition that, like, we're in this new era of new technologies and how do we make that work with the car without actually fundamentally changing the car? And you get these interesting things where a Tesla, again, it looks like a smartphone. It's more smartphone-like than other cars. But if you really understand what a smartphone is, it's not a smartphone. It's still very much a car. It's a big, heavy,
both
privately
Tesla,
owned.
This is
interesting that both of them are right now, Tesla's in trouble, right? In a number of ways. Apple kind of gave up on this thing. To me, it's because they weren't trying to unbundle the car. They were trying to make a new car that somehow brings together these new technologies that want to be something very different.
So that's right. So they didn't make a worse car. But they also I said this many times when I was critical of Tesla, many people would pile on and say, you don't get it and so on. And I just said, look, all I know is this. All I know is the disruption theory, okay? And the theory could be wrong, but this is what it says. It says that you can't create a new market if you're taking the same product forward and making it better. That's a sustaining innovation. It's not disruptive. Now, sustaining may not be bad. In fact, sustaining is probably most of the value creation in the world, but don't call it disruptive. What it has to do to be that is to be something other than car or be a worse car. So there's two things. Being a cheaper sort of, again, people's car. This is Volkswagen. This is Toyota. This is Ford Model T, etc. All of those Fiat 500, Austin Mini, all of those cars were effectively low-end entries, which revolutionized and mobilized the Western world. And we haven't figured out how to mobilize the billion in Africa and the billion in India yet to be, you know, truly revolutionary. So there's that, the sort of the low end, make it cheap, make it fun for everybody. The second thing, though, you can do to create a new market is to, you know, say it competes on a new basis. And there, the answer has to be either autonomy or something else, something that gets a job done, like micromobility, that says, like, it's more about fun, or it's more about connecting people together in new ways, right? And you know, it's what phones did. Phones with social media made human connections different than they used to be. Nobody asked for it. Nobody knew it would go in that direction. There are many pitfalls and negatives as a result, but nonetheless, we changed how people communicate. We ended up with all of these social media for good and bad. Now, the point about mobility is that it has to be like, it either revolutionizes, one of my pet theories was like, you know, people would go to places they wouldn't think of going if it wasn't for that mode. The car did that with malls. The car did that with parks, exactly, and some vacation places as well. Like the car made Miami Beach in particular. So the roads were part of that solution, of course, had to be built alongside, but so were cellular networks and phones. They're kind of symbiotic. But when you think about what would people do differently with these vehicles, when nothing Tesla does says, I'm going to use this for things I wouldn't use a car for. I wouldn't meet more people because I'm having this thing. I'm not going to change my family because of this thing. So it's like it hasn't done anything to change behaviors. So that's where you must ask it. If you're not low end, are you new direction, new basis of competition, new measure of performance? The measure of performance, by the way, is fascinating in computing when you go from like, oh, how much hard drive does it have? How much CPU and how much bandwidth does your modem have? To the discussions we're having now is like, oh, is it sexy? Is it thin? Is it long battery life? You know, these are the discussions we're having now, which means that the computer has already pivoted away from what it used to be, and so you see it in the specs. So if all we're hearing from the media who's doing reviews, let's say, is talking about the cars, you know, if they're talking about range, if they're talking about the usual specs of a car, that doesn't mean it's changed. They should be talking, how many more people are you going to meet with this product? Or how many more cool parties are you going to go to with this product? Or how much would you discover new cities or new party joints? Whatever it is, because it might be that again, self-driving would do that because you don't care about the car anymore. You're saying, well, you just hop in and say, hey, take me to the cool place in town today. It's like, and it knows, it's like a concierge, and it doesn't care. You don't care about its range. You say, this thing knows where to go, you know, and it's going to just, you know, fundamentally get me laid, excuse me, you know. But that is a human need. It's like it's going to be like connecting people. That's what made phones powerful. It wasn't their bandwidth. So yeah, how do you connect people physically?
Yeah, no, I think you're talking about something that this is for me, like just in when you talk to people about the future of mobility, you know, on the internet or whatever, like there's so much like intellectual inertia. I mean, we've had the car for a century, and there's so many mental blocks that people aren't even aware of about, like that constrain their creativity. And like, it's frustrating, I think, for those of us who like to think about the future and imagine new possibilities. But the flip side of that is that, again, like this is Tesla's success, I think proves it, which is that people have a hard time actually stepping into the future. The future is new and scary. The actual future, there's this sweet spot where it's like, we don't have to change. Everything is remains the same. We don't have to think about it. And again, this is what cars do, is they allow us to just not think about it.
And if you can't picture what we're talking about for a moment here, just imagine the world before the car, because the car did do that to the world. It came in and people discovered a new way of living. They discovered a new way to connect with people. They discovered a new places to go. And all of those things happened because the car was competing with walking and trains, mostly walking, because really trains were still for long distance travel. Maybe a little bit in the cities, you had transit options. And by the way, people think it competed with horses. Well, horses, and people in cities didn't own horses. And horses in farms were for the wealthy typically. But your peasants, I'm talking globally here, not just the United States, poor people and workers on farms didn't go around owning horses. The horse population in the United States was nowhere near the car population later on. So there was no substitution one-on-one horse to car. It was very rare transitions. But to understand how the world transitioned from pre-car to post-car, and now we're in car, and we're asking that ourselves, how could the world possibly be any different? Well, imagine the transition that are your ancestors. These aren't that far ago. This is like 2-3 generations ago that, you know, you have to ask yourself how they lived and how they ended up living just a few years later, or how their children ended up living. And it's complete transformation. Same with, by the way, phones, again, the computers, yada, yada. So my point is that when you look backwards, it inspires you to think that, yes, if we've gone this far, we can go much further by looking at it from that point of view, saying if we could only transition out of the car world into a new world, and that would be, it would be not a worse world, which is what one of the problems is, that when people hear this kind of talk about, especially on the environmental side, they think, well, I don't want people to take my car away. That's my freedom. It's not about taking it away. It's giving you something so much better that you can't imagine it today. So this is why what we have to think about, both in micromobility and Ride AI, is like, how do we spin this in a way that is more exciting and more positive, rather than saying it's constrained, worse, and cheaper?
I think you know, we are reaching the point now where, you know, again, like I think of, you know, Tesla is really reaching the limits, hopefully at least, of like how long they can sort of string along this idea that they're going to make these privately owned cars that they're selling to people self-driving. Like, it's very clearly not going to happen. It's frankly an embarrassment for the entire
by the way, just a few days ago, sorry to interrupt, but a few days ago Elon said that the robotaxi announcing in August, that was like the day after Reuters ran a story saying that the Model 2 was killed. And I'm inclined to think that those two are linked, but let's assume they're not. But what is the story on robotaxi? Because honestly, I've heard about this from Elon for years now. What's your take on that?
Well, so I think it's this fascinating, I think it's both, like the idea that autonomous vehicle technology, driving automation technology, and electric vehicle technology can just be forced into this shape. Tesla has been the champion of this idea without really even saying it, right? It's been this implicit, they've been implicitly the champion of the idea that these new technologies can just be sort of squished into the familiar form factor of the car. And both of those narratives, for me, are hitting the wall now. They're hitting the wall in the EV, in the core EV business, because you can't make a cheap EV that has 250 plus miles of range with the battery. You cannot do it. Maybe at some point in the future you will, but even then, the market that you have, even if you reduce the cost of marginal cost of batteries to, you know, effectively nothing, you have this really, it's a different market in that, right? Like when you go from a cheap gas car to an expensive gas car, you essentially get power and creature comforts. But like the freedom factor of energy density and range and refuel time are the same, whether you have a $5,000 car in India or a $500,000 Rolls Royce, right? Whereas if you go from a cheap electric car to an expensive electric car, the power, right? You can get a cheap electric car that performs really, really well, like very quick and accelerating and all that. But it's that, you know, how much battery do you have, and how ubiquitous are the chargers, and how fast are the charging rate can you have? So you're buying different things. They're fundamentally different markets. And right now, EV adoption is hitting this crisis, and Tesla exemplifies it, because they won't sell a car that doesn't meet Elon's standards of, you know, what a car should be. And he has a good intuitive sense of that. That's been a key part of their success. So that's hitting the wall, because and they can't make a cheaper car. And then also, you know, full self-driving has for years now just been this, you know, next year, next year, next year. It's never happening. And I think it's clear that they need to shore up confidence that Tesla is going to bend the curve on one of these technologies in a way that they've kind of been able to thus far. And neither is really working out. And so I think for me, the robotaxi, it's sort of like when they raise the price of the full self-driving option. It's just a way to signal confidence in something that where confidence is eroding without actually proving that the technology really works, which is the fundamental problem.
It and then they make the event. There's a lot of buildup to it. Obviously, now they have several months in which to get people to, you know, anticipate things, and then we'll have the event, and it'll be like, you know, remember they launched the robot, supposedly, like, you know, like an anthropomorphic or humanoid robot. I don't know whatever happened to that.
It was sort of the suit. They're,
so a guy in a suit, but they're going to have a robot taxi, which will probably be remotely driven. That could work, you know, and it'll give you an illusion of a self-driving, but it could be like people will be amazed by this fact that it's a taxi service. Waymo's had it for a while. All of this is fine, but it's like, to me, these are I don't find them satisfying enough to say that, look, I see this as a massive fundamental change in the core question of how to mobilize billions and billions of people. with an economy of consumption and economy of emissions that makes it sustainable. And that's the fundamental dilemma here. And again, the methods in the past have worked over and over again. Democratizing technology for billions of people, it doesn't come via $80,000, you know, 1% people can own it type of products. Maybe there's a few prototypes like that. Obviously, cell phones, when they were brand new, they were very expensive. But it took about 20 years before they were miniaturized and made commoditized enough for everyone to have. And we're not moving that quickly in that direction right now with either EV or self-driving this epiphany. One more detail is about my rant on self-driving is that there are low-hanging fruits in self-driving in the sense that you don't need to have it in a personal vehicle. You can have it in a shared vehicle, as we mentioned, but you can have it also in public transit. Like, for example, a self-driving bus is a super cool idea because the number one cost of buses is the driver. And the reason cities don't deploy large fleets of buses or bus routes is that they don't have the economics that can serve the people that are needing it because the driving costs so much. Now, if someone were to say both electric and self-driving bus, believe me, there's a huge market. Electric is already huge, but a self-driving bus would expand the entire notion of public transit globally. But somehow no one's putting energy or money into the transit aspect of self-driving, or even trains, even subway trains. You go to New York, there's no subway train that's running autonomously. All that really the driver there has to do is, you know, make sure nothing really bad goes badly. It's not like, you know, it's all that hard. I don't mean to detract from the skill of a subway driver, but nonetheless, it doesn't seem to be like there's a lot of decision making going on there. And then there are other dangerous and violent situations. For example, driving military vehicles, super, super dangerous. Now, as you see in Ukraine, that's going to be more and more remote and more autonomous. But that, where's the money coming to make those types of vehicles which save lives or at least protect the lives of soldiers, right? That's a huge, it seems like a huge desirable feature set. And then finally, agriculture, shipping, big vessels, the costs involved there, agricultural vehicles, all that stuff. And those are very constrained domains compared to level 5. And I ask myself, if it's easier to do these low-hanging fruit type solutions, why aren't dollars going into those investments because of the sort of, and I know there's been investments, but nothing compared to what's going on with the so-called personal self-driving vehicle that is a nice to have feature, honestly, you know, whereas the other ones are damn good necessity and damn good return on investment if you make it work.
Yeah. So, and I think I have a theory for this, which is that, you know, Silicon Valley venture capitalists want to invest in platforms. And I think a lot of the malinvestment of the last decade in mobility and particularly there's been this overfocus on cars because they are a general purpose platform. It's a mobility, right? And it's like, oh, if you can just take the car and change it, and we can somehow capture that as a platform the way Google has captured search as a platform for the internet, right? I mean, I think that's how people think of it, is the car is like the search engine for the, it's the Google. Google doesn't always give you the best search results, but it's, you just don't think about it. You just go to Google and you type it in and you get whatever you get. That's the car, right? And people.
Yeah, but it's also news only an hour a day. So it's not a platform that you can leverage for the sort of extended application time that you need to create experiences. So the reason people would be attracted to a car, let's say if you did make it as a platform, and you wanted to write apps for it, well, it would be very limited because there would be like either some attention that is somehow not good enough to use a phone for. Okay, somehow a phone is not good enough for that environment. So that has some, and I asked myself, okay, so it has to last a fairly short amount of time. It has to use onboard displays, which are somehow better than what you have in your pocket. And your pocket isn't good enough. So when you start to work out the environment where those applications would be valuable, it's really a small footprint there. And that's why I'm struggling to see.
So maybe I mean more
why
like
that makes sense.
More like an interface than a platform, right? So think of like OpenAI, like the idea of using voice as this thing that can now replace typing in searches and doing all these other things, right? So the idea though is that cars are this general purpose device, and if you can sort of capture that or replace it with something, that it's this massive market. But more importantly, it's how people interface with the real world. There's a huge, all kinds of potential in that. The problem is that, and this is particularly the case, electrification is a little bit different, but on the automation side, right, there's no such thing as general purpose automation. And I think this is something that, again, like the focus on wanting to get platform, grand slam platform investments. That's what makes venture capital work. And so they're always looking for those things. The problem is that stop thinking of it as a car and in the automation term, think of it as a robot, right? So like robots, real robots look like the task that they do, right? Whether it's cleaning a pool or cleaning a window or mowing your lawn or whatever, like a robot is designed for a task. And some of these tasks are, right, it's what make this one weld, you know, it's an arm with a tool in a cage and you make that one, well, that's on one sort of end of a spectrum of automation. And the other is like C-3PO, right? Like humanoid walking robot. And I think if you think about cars are the humanoid robot. And I think it's not a coincidence that Tesla is the company that's saying you're going to have a car that you can buy at a normal price and it's going to drive you level 5 anywhere you want to go. They're also the one saying, and by the way, it's be made by these general purpose humanoid robots. These are both science fiction fantasies, and you know it because fundamentally what they're selling is general purpose automation, which can't exist. But this is why venture capital. Yeah. Sorry.
It's just so strong. You know, it just reminds me of this conversation about form factor, the robot that is humanoid. And I asked myself, well, what if you had a self-driving vehicle, what form would it take? And the assumption that a self-driving vehicle looks like your average family car is very strange to me, because it obviously would like to give you different opportunities to change what you do. So here's where I took it when I had a SIM car as a podcast, and I called it the autonomous Winnebago, because in the Winnebago or RV, for those of you who are not in America, the RV notion is that it's space, it's living space, it's a house on wheels, and so the logic of a car is that okay, you're all sitting facing forward, and what, your arms are crossed instead of on the wheel, but that means why should it be facing forward? Oh, because you have to pay attention to the road. No, you don't. So you're gonna face anywhere. Well, you're gonna face anywhere. Why as well, we, you know, make it a box. So actually, a van is much more logical. In fact, this is why Apple's probably was exploring vans. They called it the bread loaf concept, right? It was a space, and in that space, suddenly things are possible which weren't possible in the car, which is four forwards facing seats. But then you pull the thread on that. Keep pulling. Okay, so it's a space. What are you going to do in there? What? Be productive. Be entertained. Sleep. Exercise. Have fun. Have a party. Why not? Drink all you want. Sure. Okay, then you take that a step further. Well, make it bigger is the obvious answer. So you want to have more space, more people, more fun, more partying, more sleeping, more exercising. And then that becomes a big, big space. And then it's logical that the machine, okay, where are you going to park it? Who cares? It's self-driving. It self-parks. So it drops you off at your destination. Now you're hungover, unfortunately, but you're dropped off at your destination. And the thing just goes off by itself, like a you know, slowly lumbering car or house. And then it parks itself in the cheapest location it can find. Okay, it's pre-programmed to do so, so it doesn't cost you money. But then if that location is not found at all, it just keeps roaming. And it's like, you know, like this, it just, and then feeds itself some electricity once in a while, but it just literally goes in a circle around the block all day long, all night long, because why? The parking is expensive, but the electricity presumably is cheap. You keep pulling. And then what do you get to this? You get like a ring road around cities, which is filled with Winnebagos going like cows in a herd nonstop, 24/7 popping out of orbit once in a while to go find you, to take you maybe back to orbit so you can sleep it off or party more and so on. So the logical thing for self-driving is an orbit of Winnebago-style vehicles that pay no parking, pay no taxes for real estate, and you live on them, and you go somewhere else when you don't want to be there.
You can have an entire temporary city. You get these Winnebagos together, and you could have a little city temporarily orbiting itself, and then everyone kind of goes their separate ways. Well, I mean, there's so many possibilities.
And I kept pulling, and I said, well, wait a minute. Parking is almost free. This is why you have people's RVs cluttering up towns in the United States, because parking is almost free. And if you go far away enough from the downtown, you can get to more or less free parking. But real estate is super expensive. So either pay for an $800,000 house or pay for an $80,000 RV, which actually is a living space and it self-parks and self-feeds and all these other things. So the natural conclusion for self-driving is it upends housing. Unless the laws are written, and the laws have to be written to say that, no, it's illegal to park your RV anywhere. Okay, then people will migrate with these RVs off in the desert somewhere to live. You know, this is what the concept, this is what we did with cars. We created cities, we created highways, we created new living spaces, new working spaces, new shopping spaces, just because the car existed. So if the self-driving car exists, it does and necessarily will affect housing. And yet no one's talking about this. All that we have is the ersatz, automobile is what happens to be self-driving. And I say, hold on, if it's real, it's going to be very different.
Yeah. And I think that's such an important point because what it shows is that these technologies force you to blur. If you say, okay, what do these technologies want to be? It forces you to blur the lines of categories that are so entrenched for us that most people don't think it's even possible to blur these lines between, right, the vehicle and the system that it's a part of. And I think there's something unique about the car that resists the idea that it's part of a system. This is why in the US we buy, you know, increasingly SUVs and trucks, is because we want it to be agnostic of its context. We want it to perform. We want that extra bit of capability, so that we can be up in the mountain peak somewhere, out in a desert somewhere, and it will work, right? Whereas with electric, for example, it's all about centered on the home. You know, we're out, you know, thinking that we're going to solve electric adoption by putting fast chargers on freeways, because that's where we see the problem with electric cars fitting into the model that we have. But really, when you realize, okay, this was more of it. We're not just replacing one kind of car with another. We actually can start to think about blurring the lines between the vehicle and the system that it's a part of. What we should really be doing, you know, you look at all of the data that, you know, you've been championing for years, shoving in people's face for years. Now look at the trip data. What we should be incentivizing is putting a charger in every single home and apartment, right? Because most trips start at home.
Even
most trips end
spots.
At home. Everywhere. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, and right, like we're so hung up on that 1%, 2% worth of capability.
It's less than that. I saw the data that this is the transportation data for the United States, and the people think that again, highway trips are super important. Well, I try to estimate the percentage of trips that exhaust the battery in the typical, you know, EV as people ask for. So if people ask for 400 miles, let's say that's the dream, and everybody's demanding it. Okay, I'm not going to buy a car unless it's 400 miles. Well, as the 400 mile distance is so rarely driven that it's about 1 in 500 trips a person takes in, and that means it's once every year and a half or so. And so it's so rare. And I think actually some people take a lot of them and most people take none. So the road trip is going extinct and most people will fly rather than drive, even if it's 100 miles. And so although they say that they're going to, you know, want to have a 400 mile, they'll never take a 400 mile trip, statistically speaking. And therefore, why are you putting superchargers up in the, you know, in the remote parts of the country? When in fact, everywhere you stop, you should charge. So if you have a small battery, but everywhere you stop, you can charge, then suddenly it makes sense. And that brings the question up, why is the U.S. so bad at infrastructure? Because actually other countries like China and Europe, they put up charges like there's nothing. It's like every gas station pretty much now can get a charger in it. But no, in the U.S., it's like you got to have an act of Congress to have a bunch of chargers in the middle of nowhere, and badly placed and badly operational and badly everything. I have tried this EV America stuff. It never worked for me. So my point is that it's like this brings back, sorry to just reminisce a bit, but brings back this one of these things I said when I wrote the Ten Commandments of the Automobility or the, you know, whatever it was called.
The new car, the entrance guide to the car industry.
The entrance guide to automobility, but came to be known as the Ten Commandments. And one of them was that if you want to study the future of the car, study roads. Yeah. And this is like saying, if you understand the future of computing, study cellular networks, because actually cellular networks turned out to be the enabling technology for the whole damn thing. And yet very few people still today appreciate them. And yet how much investment went there, how much government regulation was necessary, and et cetera. And people who, it's even more important that the road network to the automobile than the cellular network was to the computer. It's far more important. They just don't, you could have a computer off the net. You can't have a car without roads. You just can't.
Yeah.
This is why it's such a puzzle, you know.
Yeah. No, and I think, you know, you're always so, you've got such an optimistic view of like an exciting and fun and like sexy future and everything. But a lot of times, like for me, exactly as you say, there's also a just sort of, we can't just keep doing what we're doing kind of a thing. And like here in Portland where I live, right, so the city, the east side was mostly built around streetcars. And now as cars are getting bigger and bigger, so there's been a lot of infill development, so more density, more sort of apartments and condos. They're required to not have parking garages to make these more walkable neighborhoods. The problem is people are still keeping their cars. And so you have more and more cars street parked in these neighborhoods with narrow roads. Cars are getting bigger and wider. And there are huge swaths of the city now where if you want to go down, you know, a street, you have to wait at the end of the block, make sure nobody is coming, because if there's cars parked on both sides of the street, you can only get one-way traffic through anymore. And I think it's really important to recognize that, you know, keep making cars bigger, wider, more powerful, more capable. Obviously, there are forces driving that, but it can't go on forever. And I think when I look at my city, at least there's signs that that's starting to push back. And for me, it's not about replacing them. It's about really, and again, this is why this is such a treat to talk to you, but like we have to unbundle these, right? We have to stop taking our trucks, SUVs into cities at all. Let's use bikes in those cities, right? And let's use the trucks when we want to go out to the desert.
Yeah, and that's one of the early slides I did is like, you know, if you took the distribution of distances and you put along that curve, you put different vehicles. So you have, you know, 0 to 100 yards walking, then you put bicycle, scooter, blah, 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 e-bike, and then put the car somewhere in the middle. But behind the car, you're going to have different things for very long trips. And so what happens is the bundling notion is that one size fits all, the car is used for short trips and long trips, whereas the micromobility thesis is use small vehicles for small distances, use big vehicles for big distances. It doesn't exclude the car, but the car actually sits somewhere in the middle of that spectrum. And so the question also, when you sprinkle a bit of self-driving, even if it isn't perfect, that is good enough self-driving, then you start to even break the car even further. So you're going to say like, okay, self-driving car actually takes over a different chunk, most likely more of the short distances, I would say, if it is a shared vehicle, if it is actually a taxi, in which case, again, you unbundle even more the car. And the way I would tell auto executives, I remember the story, is I said, you guys are not going to go out of business. You're just going to lose half your business. And that's all. That's all. And then, you know, take it easy. Don't worry, man. You know, micro is not to get you. That was my, you know, it's the way it works. The miles, if you make it a market for miles or a market for trips, it's obvious. But again, back to the computer, if you make it a market for apps and you start to divide the computing world into apps and you say, oh, there's social apps, there's heavy load duty productivity apps. And yeah, the personal computer still has productivity. Congratulations. But you lost communications and entertainment. Okay, PC's still going, right? Microsoft's still going. It's pivoting nicely into new stuff like AI, but let it go. You know, let go the idea that you need to be the one computer that fits all in terms of all the things people use computers for. And then you build new things to use computers for, and then that new stuff actually is all on the new devices, not in the old stuff. So that's just the way I think. And that's why, you know, we're still on this journey. And I think that as new technology comes along and also maybe old dreams die, new dreams are born. There's not a loss of optimism. It's just, it's interesting the journey we're going on. We're going through, you know, and business models are going to evolve. Business models are going to disappear. We're not in the business of saying we know how we're going to get there. We're in the business, you and I would say, we're in the business of saying we know the world's going to change and it's going to probably go in that direction. But the path there is unclear. And by the way, anyone who says, this is important, anyone who says, I know exactly how it's going to go, treat with great skepticism, because that is the false prophet. They're so sure of the path and the timing. When you know it's chaotic, when you know it's necessarily complex, and every time in history someone has made that claim early, they've proven to be wrong. So be cautious out there. That's my advice.
Absolutely. Well, and for me, my sort of corollary to that is that, can people have real conversations? If someone is just talking at you, that's one thing. If you can have a real conversation, you're exchanging ideas, that's someone who is actually thinking things through, who is looking to others to sharpen their views and their insights, which, Horace, is why I always just get such a kick chatting with you. You've been one of those people for me for a very long time now. Hopefully this conversation helps people see why that's the case. And I really look forward to continuing to have more conversations like this with you in the future.
Loving it. I appreciate it. Thank you so much, Ed.
Yeah, thank you.